right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this Honorable Court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. This is the Chief Justice, and good morning to everyone. And I'm about to be seated in the courtroom, and everybody else can be seated also. And we are now going to proceed with our second case of the day using teleconferencing, and that is In Re Estate of Adelung. My apologies to both counsel if I've mispronounced that name. I'm going to start by doing a roll to make sure that everybody is on the call who's supposed to be on the call. So first of all, Mr. Krejci, are you here?
I am, Your Honor.
Thank you. And Mr. Johnson, are you here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to do a roll of the court. Justice Miller-Lerman, are you here?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Justice Castle?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. Justice Stacy?
I'm here, Chief.
Justice Funk?
Chief, I'm recused from this matter, so I will be stepping off.
Okay, real good. I apologize. I forgot that. Justice Papik?
I'm here.
Very good. And Justice Frydenberg?
I'm here as well.
Everybody is here and ready to go, and the procedure we're going to follow for the attorneys, you have 10 minutes per side. We will give each of you 5 minutes to present your case without interruption by members of the court, and then we will break to ask questions by members of the court. And appellant, you will still have the opportunity to ask for whatever rebuttal time you wish, which we may or may not get to, depending on how long the questioning takes. With that in mind, do either of the attorneys have any questions about that process?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. So we will begin the argument then with Mr. Krejci.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May I attempt to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal time?
You may indeed.
All right, thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jared Krejci, and I represent Kent Adelung, the appellant in this action. This case involves several interesting questions, in my opinion, regarding statutory interpretation and the jurisdiction of the county court, and I hope that we can reach those issues in the question and answer period. Before that, I wanted to focus my time on some factual issues and maybe less interesting issues that I think could be difficult to glean from a cold record. First of all, one issue that the county court erred regarding is applying the statute of limitations. This action involves transactions that occurred as early as the year 2000, and the petition was filed on February 1st, 2016. So it is the appellant's position that any transactions that occurred prior to February 1st, 2012 are barred by the statute of limitations. There was no tolling theory pled in the petition. There were no facts that would create any type of tolling theory. So the statute of limitation should bar any recovery for transactions that occurred prior to February 1st, 2012. I also wanted to point out that the facts were absolutely undisputed that Madeline Adelung, the decedent, consented to all of the transactions disputed in this action. There are essentially two series of transactions. In the year 2000, Kent Adelung began receiving the rent from Madeline Adelung's farm. That rent transaction is challenged. And in the year 2008, Madeline Adelung began writing monthly $2,000 checks to Kent Adelung. She wrote 23 checks, or at least signed 23 checks personally. And then after that, Kent Adelung began using a power of attorney to sign the checks in Madeline's name, using that power of attorney. So Madeline established this $2,000 per month check pattern. That's evidence other than Kent Adelung's word that Madeline consented to these transactions. Also, the long period of time is additional evidence that Madeline consented to this. She monitored her financial affairs, and that's additional evidence other than Kent Adelung's word that his mother consented to these transactions. I also wanted to point out that I would ask the court to look at the language of the power of attorney. There's argument in the appellee's brief that the power of attorney could be used only for the purpose of reducing federal estate tax liability. And if you look at the entirety of the language of the power of attorney, we certainly dispute that argument. The power of attorney does not give a blanket gifting authority. So if the common law before the new Power of Attorney Act is relevant to this issue, this is not a blanket gifting clause. This is specifically grants authority to gift to Kent Adelung. I also wanted to point out the issue of latches, and the appellant certainly concedes that latches is not a favorable defense, but it is still part of the law, and it produces a just result in this case. The long passage of time from the year 2000 to 2016, when this action was filed, it shows that Madeline Adelung consented to all of these transactions. So in this particular case, it produces a just result in line with Madeline Adelung's intention. And there was prejudice to Kent over the long passage of time. There is evidence in the record that if Madeline Adelung approached Kent and told him that she did not want him to continue with these transactions, he would have abided by her word. So the long passage of time allowed, you know, these amounts to build up into a very large number. And along the way, Kent relied upon these financial transactions and built his life around the money that he received from his mother for a period of over 15 years. So there is prejudice to Kent Adelung due to the passage of time. As to the jurisdictional issues and the statutory interpretation issues.
Mr. Krejci, I think the 5 minutes is up. So.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Appreciate that. We will go to some questions, and I will begin those questions with Justice Castle.
Thank you. I have a series of questions, so I will appreciate if you can keep the answers as brief as possible. You have a motion to judicially notice legislative history and to also notice another court's records, but the other court that you're talking about is the county court from which the appeal is taken, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And isn't that something that would customarily be covered by a supplemental transcript?
Your Honor, if you look at the precipice for transcript as well as the precipice for bill of exceptions, I initially attempted to have that record that I'm seeking to have judicially noticed produced by the normal method of the transcript or the bill of exceptions. The clerk stated that the record of payment was not a pleading, and I could not have it sent to this court by the precipice for transcript or bill of exceptions. So I did attempt that, and the motion for judicial notice was my secondary option, Your Honor.
Thank you. The next question is regarding your jurisdictional arguments. Had this case been filed by the personal representative in the district court, would you be making any jurisdictional argument at all?
No, Your Honor.
If, on the other hand, the same petition had been filed, not docketed on the probate docket of the county court, but docketed on the civil docket of the county court, would you be making a jurisdictional argument?
If that occurred, Your Honor, it would take away the jurisdictional argument involving the in re estate of Lambie argument. And that argument's somewhat separate in that when a county court is sitting as a probate court, the probate court does not have authority to enter personal judgments against devisees just because they're a devisee. So it would take away that arrow, but there would still be some other arguments, Your Honor.
Would you briefly cite them or recite them, not arguing them, but just tell me what the identify those other arguments?
The other arguments, Your Honor, is that the county court under Section 24517, that statute purports to state that county courts have jurisdiction over matters involving powers of attorney. I argue that 24517 does not actually change the jurisdiction of the county court, and if 24517 does not give the county court jurisdiction over this action, it's completely an equity action, and in that case, the county court doesn't have jurisdiction.
Thank you. Now, with respect to your citation of the Lambie case, the Lambie case is from 1965, which predates the current constitutional and statutory provisions regarding county courts. And historians will be well aware that the nature of our county courts changed rather dramatically in the early 1970s because of those constitutional and statutory changes. Why do you believe that the Lambie case still has validity under the current statutory and constitutional scheme?
Well, Your Honor, I must admit I am not fully prepared to give a very good answer to that question, but I would just state that there is a practicality of not having probate cases turn into wrongful death cases, into all types of cases that are only in a probate docket because they involve a personal representative.
Thank you. I want to turn to your statute of limitations argument. You're arguing there's a four-year statute, and as I read your opponent's brief, he seems to be arguing the same thing. So we'll go with that. What rationale did you discern from the county court's decision regarding its consideration of the statute of limitations?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the county court addressed that issue in its order.
All right. And when do you contend that the cause of action or causes of action accrued with respect to the transactions which occurred?
I contend that they accrued either when the checks were written or when they were deposited.
Thank you. You touched on your argument about the power of attorney and the county court's jurisdiction, and I think you rely in part on Section 30-4006 sub 1, which refers to the county court having concurrent jurisdiction to determine the validity and enforceability of a power of attorney, whereas Section 24-517 refers to concurrent original jurisdiction in any matter relating to a power of attorney and the action or inaction of any agent acting under a power of attorney. How do we reconcile the difference between these two statutes?
Your Honor, I argue that between these two statutes, there is an ambiguity. They cover the same area, which is county court jurisdiction, and I propose that they should be construed in pari materia. And the purpose of construing statutes in that manner is to give effect to each and every part of the statute. And if 24-517 means that the county courts have jurisdiction over any matter involving a power of attorney, that would make 30-4006 superfluous. And when you read statutes in pari materia, you want to avoid making statutes superfluous. And given that creates an ambiguity, once an ambiguity is found, you can go to legislative history. And in this case, the legislative history is very clear and states that Section 24-517 does not do anything to change jurisdiction of the county courts. It only lists areas where the county courts have jurisdiction.
All right. With respect to the Nebraska Uniform Power of Attorney Act, that act became effective January 1 of 2013, and we have transactions in this case both before and after the effective date of that act. Would you argue as to whether you believe the new act applies to the pre-act effective date transactions, only to the post-effective date transactions, or both, and what is your reasoning?
Your Honor, I think there are only two correct possible outcomes. And the first, which is my primary argument, is that the effective date provision of the new Power of Attorney Act, there's essentially three subsections. And in this matter, there is some contradiction between them. And if you look at the Uniform Trust Code, it contains nearly identical language. And it also contains a comment or reporter's note that states the purpose of this language is to be retroactive as much as possible, as long as that retroactivity doesn't offend constitutional principles. So my primary argument is that since no constitutional principles of due process are disrupted by applying the new act retroactively in this action, it should apply to everything. Now, the other possible reading, I believe, is that the transactions that occurred prior to the effective date are governed by the old act and the common law, and from the effective date to the later transactions, they're governed by the new act. But I think that's the other option, but I think it's incorrect, Your Honor.
Thank you. My last question will be with respect to your argument that the failure to pay a filing fee was jurisdictional. Assuming for purposes of this question that we were to conclude that it was proper to docket the petitioner's cause of action on the probate docket of the county court, do you have any authority for the proposition that the failure to pay a filing fee is jurisdictional? For example, in the appeal context, failing to pay a docket fee or to deposit a docket fee from the court being appealed from is clearly made jurisdictional expressly by statute. Here we have no statute making it jurisdictional, or do we have any cases making it jurisdictional? Would you address that?
Your Honor, I think that issue is determined purely from the statute that requires the docket fee. And in my view, that statute is silent as to the question of whether this requirement is jurisdictional. So I really do not believe there's any argument in favor of it being jurisdictional or against. And my argument is really based on that ambiguity as a matter of policy. It's better to construe the statute to be jurisdictional.
Thank you. That's all the questions that I have.
Thank you very much, Justice Stacy.
No questions.
Justice Funk. Oh, I'm sorry, he's recused. Justice Papik.
No questions.
Justice Frydenberg?
No questions.
Justice Miller-Lerman?
Justice Castle asked all my questions. No questions.
Very good. And I, too, have no questions. So we went over 7 minutes on that. We'll try and take that into consideration. Mr. Johnson, and good morning to you again. And Mr. Johnson, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, this is Blake Johnson on behalf of the Appellee Cross Appellant Linda Hyden, the personal representative for the estate of Madeline Adelung. I'd like to start by discussing a bit on the subject matter jurisdiction issue because it was stressed heavily in the briefing by the appellant. I think that if you look at the statutes, or if we look back maybe procedurally, informal probate was initiated in the county court in January of 2015. And then the petition itself was filed as part of that docket a little more than a year later in February of 2016. And it was filed by the personal representative in their capacity as a personal representative against Kent Adelung, who is an heir to the estate of Madeline Adelung. And the purpose of it was to seek an accounting of property for the estate that was removed. The county court did address, although there wasn't a motion technically filed at the lower level, I believe it was just simply emailed to the court, but the county court addressed the issue and it's very briefly in its order and concluded that it did have jurisdiction. And I think that while it did not expound upon its decision, I think the statutes that are relevant here, because as we know, typically in equity actions, the district court has jurisdiction per the Constitution, and county courts are of limited jurisdiction unless there's an additional statutory authorization. And the statutory authorization that we're talking about here is actually two sections, 24.517, which provides the county court exclusive original jurisdiction over probate matters, and 30-2211, county court jurisdiction over all subject matter relating to estates of decedents. I think by their plain language, then, this case, which again involved the probate, it involved the personal representative, an heir, and property subject to the estate, certainly seems to fall under the plain language of that statute. The question arises when we're talking about the equitable nature of the action for an accounting. However, this court in a series of cases has said that the county court, when it's exercising its probate jurisdiction, can apply equitable principles. And I would refer the court to its decisions in Washington versus Conley, Patak versus Swanson, and very recently here in Brinkman versus Brinkman, which is 302 Nebraska 315. The argument, I guess, that the county court does not have subject matter jurisdiction to me is a bit confusing, and while not addressed specifically in the briefs, I would note that the notice of appeal was filed and it brought the case directly from the county court to the Court of Appeals under Nebraska Revised Statute 30-1601. 30-1601 provides that a direct appeal of that sort is appropriate if it's an appeal in matters arising under the Nebraska Probate Code. Presumably then otherwise the standard default would apply and the appeal from the county court should go to the district court first. So if this isn't a matter arising under the Nebraska Probate Code and the county court was not exercising probate jurisdiction, I'm not sure that the appeal was properly perfected because it should have gone to the district court. However, I do believe that it was a matter involving probate and that's why we have not challenged that. But the court certainly in this instance found, you know, subject matter jurisdiction was present, and I don't believe that there's any reason not to. The court did not make any specific findings on theories, legal theories that were pled, which involve conversion, breach of fiduciary duty, constructive trust. While I think the cases of Washington versus Conley, Patak, Swanson, and Brinkman, allow the court to render decisions on those claims. Here, the court in its order does not specifically find that one or other of those theories was the determinative factor, or that its decision turned on one or other of those theories. It simply found that as a matter of equity, for example, in the petition, it was pled that there was, you know, the blanket request for any other relief deemed just and equitable. The court found as a matter of equity, once Madeline Adelung had been confined to assisted living or in a nursing home, that it was no longer equitable for Kent, under the, at least under the claim that they're making, to receive compensation for her care, because now she was paying for care and being cared for by these facilities.
Mr. Johnson, I think your 5 minutes is up, so we're going to go to questions, and we'll start again with Justice Cass.
Thank you, Chief. Counsel, I have, again, for you a number of questions, and I want to start with asking you what specific section of the Uniform Probate Code, as distinguished from the Nebraska Uniform Power of Attorney Act, focusing now on the probate code, what statute authorized this procedure that you invoked by filing this petition in the probate docket? Can you cite me to one or more statutes of the probate code that authorized that procedure?
Your Honor, I cannot reference a statute in the probate code or a section of the probate code that would specifically address this. I think generally the powers of the personal representative as set forth under the probate code allow the personal representative to do anything that is necessary to resolve or settle the estate. And it was with that authority in mind that the petition was filed by the personal representative on behalf of the estate to address these questions concerning estate property.
Now, you're familiar with our jurisprudence regarding equity cases and the probate code in the county court, and we have a case that's post the changes to the Constitution and the statute that held that the county court does not have equitable jurisdiction to enter an injunction or provide injunctive relief. On the other hand, there is a specific statute in the probate code addressing partition, and partition is specifically authorized under the probate code as part of a probate proceeding. I'm interested to explore the difference between those two things, particularly given that you have not addressed a specific statute. And to do that, I want to ask, well, let me first ask, before I get to that, you would agree with me, would you not, that the, just by definition of the code section, the Nebraska Uniform Power of Attorney Act is not part of the Nebraska Probate Code, correct?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, yes.
All right. So I wanted to ask you a series of questions. Suppose we have an estate where the decedent was, at the time of her death, a landlord and had rented a real property for residential purposes to a tenant. And assume for purposes of the question, at least initially, that the tenant was in no way related to the decedent, was a third party. Do you believe that a failure to pay rent could be enforced by a petition in the probate proceeding to recover possession of the property in the nature of a forcible entry and detainer proceeding?
I do not, Your Honor. I think that that would be outside of the court's probate jurisdiction, given that it involves a dispute between a creditor and a third party, even though the creditor in this instance would be the decedent. I believe that that particular scenario would be something that potentially falls outside the court's exclusive jurisdiction, and therefore would probably need to be filed in the district court.
Well, could it, in the forcible entry and detainer context, could it be filed in the county court's general civil docket by the personal representative?
I suppose that it could, if you're filing it outside of the context of the court's probate jurisdiction. I think that there'd simply be a jurisdictional question if you tried to do it within the probate docket as to whether the court was really exercising probate jurisdiction in that, or if it was simply going and weighing in on the enforceability or liability pursuant to a contract with a third party.
Okay, I want to switch to hypothetical just a little bit and assume that the decedent was a farmer, and as it happens, there was a farm involved, at least earlier in the proceedings. But in my second hypothetical, assume that the decedent is a farmer, and just prior to the decedent's death, there was a corn crop being grown by the decedent, and the neighbors applied pesticides or insecticides negligently that drifted in and destroyed the decedent's corn crop. Is that the sort of thing that the claim against the neighboring farmer could be asserted by a petition filed in the probate asserting some liability?
Again, Your Honor, I think that because you're talking about liability under a tort theory relating to a third party, that really does not have, I don't think it has, it's not inextricably tied to the probate of the estate, and therefore would not be properly before the county court, at least insofar as it's exercising probate jurisdiction.
Would you agree with me that the county court's decision in this case seems to be focused solely on the power of attorney and not on any other sort of relationship between the decedent and Camp Catalan?
I would agree that with respect to what we've kind of come to refer to as the gift checks, the county court's decision seemed to focus solely on the power of attorney. And I think with respect to the farm rent, it's a little less unclear as to whether the court viewed that as a power of attorney issue, or if it came under some sort of a confidential trust relationship that arose simply by virtue of the relationship of the parties. I think that question is left not specifically answered by the county court in its order.
Your initial petition, the pleading upon which this proceeding went forward, does not allege that the decedent was incompetent, nor does it allege the exercise of undue influence, correct?
No, Your Honor, yes, Your Honor, that's correct. I don't believe that our claims ever tended to turn on necessarily a finding of incapacity or incompetence or undue influence.
What other than the power of attorney, which came into existence in 2008, what is the source of any fiduciary relationship upon which you rely between Kent Adelung and the deceased?
Prior to 2008, I believe that the record shows that, and per Mr. Adelung's own testimony, that he developed a confidential trust relationship where his mother essentially was relying on him to deal with her financial affairs, even though it had not been put in writing. At that time, the financial affairs simply involved management of the farm, and the record shows that, you know, in 1987, prior to the death of the decedent's husband, there was a 50-50 arrangement with the father. But as soon as the father is out of the picture and mom has this life estate, Mr. Adelung or Kent starts taking, sort of changes the dynamic with his mother and starts taking the income from the rent. And I think that the overarching concern with this situation is that there was no written authorization for that transaction or any of the financial transactions going forward from 2000 till Madeline's death in October of 2014. And this court's decision in Archbold versus Reinfreth says that A purported oral authorization is insufficient to justify that type of self-dealing, and it's for good policy reason because Ms. Adelung now is deceased, and we can't find out. And so Kent's testimony, to the extent that he suggests Madeline authorized it, that purported oral authorization without express written consent is insufficient.
And how do we do it? In the absence of allegations of undue influence or lack of capacity, how do we get from the confidential family relationship to fiduciary liability? That seems to me to be a gap that I'm having trouble how you surmount.
I believe, Your Honor, it would be under sort of a theory of constructive trust, the equitable theory that, you know, if you have this confidential trust relationship, a fiduciary duty arises by virtue of that under the court's cases, under the common law. And Kent Adelung owed a duty to act in his mother's best interest as a fiduciary. And in this case, it's sort of evident that the interest that he was seeking to protect was his own, and really not anything that would lead to a better scenario for his mother.
Okay, and the last area that I want to pursue with you is the effective date of the Nebraska Uniform Power of Attorney Act of January 1, 2013. The power of attorney in this case precedes that date. However, the act seems to apply to powers of attorney that were executed before the effective date of the act. You agree with that?
Yes, there's certainly a retroactive provision within the statute.
And we have transactions before and after, and then the gift provisions of the act are significantly different than the pre-existing law. Would you discuss how, in your view, the change in the law interacts with the specific situation that we have in this case, with pre and post transactions and pre and post gifts, and which statute applies? And I said it was the last one, but I do actually want to touch on one last one about the standard of review, but I'll let you answer this question first.
Your Honor, I think that with respect to acts taken prior to January of 2013, January 1st, 2013, the Uniform Power of Attorney Act is not intended to apply. I think that the court had discussed that in what I acknowledge is an unpublished or unreported opinion in Haley versus Hytrek that was rendered in 2016, but simply saying that you would have, there would be no need for the additional language in subsection 4 subsection 4 of section 30-4045. If the act was intended to apply retroactively to actions or transactions taken prior to. So essentially it allows a power of attorney to be enforceable, but any acts taken under that or the language to be enforceable, but the actions taken pursuant to it are outside the retroactive scope of the provision. And with respect to the provision in the gifting clause here in the power of attorney, I think there's the question of this exoneration clause as well, but we still have sort of a reckless, the facts show that the power of attorney here was acting recklessly in disregard of the best interest. And I believe that whether you're applying the old statute or the new, the scenario remains the same, that there, with absent a written authorization and express intent, this purported oral authorization is simply insufficient. And the language in the statute, in the power of attorney itself, is not specifically clear enough to allow for the writing of 62 gift checks for $2,000 a piece. And Madeline, just to be clear, because Mr. Krejci pointed out, said that Madeline wrote these checks. If you look at Exhibit 8, where the checks are contained, those checks were not written by Madeline. She executed a few. They were signed, but the balance of the check and the amount was actually written by Kent in his own hand, and then checks just began to be signed by him as well.
Does it matter in your, well, if Madeline personally signed the check, does it matter that she didn't write the balance of the check?
I think it's some indication that there's a lack of express consent, ratification, or knowledge of what that was going toward. If she was able to execute the check, okay.
And last, on the standard of review, the probate standard of review for error on the record is one standard, but of course the equitable standard would be de novo on the record, which is somewhat different. Part of the problem that I'm having with the case is determining exactly what your cause of action was, or at least the way that the county court determined it. And it seems to me the county court's relying on the Nebraska Uniform Power of Attorney Act provision, which does seem to be a proceeding in equity. Do you disagree?
I do not disagree that it would be a proceeding in equity.
All right. Thank you for the answers, and I apologize for taking so much time to my colleagues.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. On we go. Justice Stacy.
No questions. Thank you.
Justice Papik.
Mr. Johnson, what is the argument on that you're making as to why these claims were timely? Is it argument based on the date that they accrued, or are you relying on some tolling doctrine? And if so, what doctrine are you relying on?
Justice Papik, we're relying on, as far as the timeliness of them, are on the discovery rule. If the discovery rule is applicable, then the statute of limitations does not begin to run until the potential plaintiff discovers or could have discovered. And here, the potential plaintiff being the personal representative or the estate itself, it was unclear from the record that anybody had knowledge of this. And the burden is on the defendant here, or the appellant, to prove express knowledge. And the discovery rule itself kind of turns on an equitable principle where it's manifestly unjust for the statute of limitations to run before they could have become aware. So the tolling doctrine, I suppose, here is the discovery rule. And as soon as...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Does Madeline's knowledge, if any, have any bearing on when the claims were discovered for purposes of the discovery rule?
I don't know that it does, because the potential plaintiff here would be the personal representative of the estate or the estate itself.
And so what would under your understanding then, could the personal representative ever discover claims before being appointed as the personal representative?
Yes, I think they could. If the person in this instance, Linda Hayden, was aware of the transactions, there would be an argument to be made that those claims had accrued because of her awareness of those transactions. However, the record here indicates that Kent Adelung had never shared any of this information with any of his family members, and so their knowledge did not arise until appointment as personal representative, and Ms. Hayden began sort of examining the record, and this power of attorney came to light, and then the bank records were subpoenaed, and discovery occurred at that time.
Thank you. I have no additional questions.
Justice Frydenberg.
Thank you.
I have no questions.
Justice Miller-Lerman.
Just to follow up with respect to Justice Papik's line of inquiry and see if I understood the dialogue. If a potential beneficiary, that is, as qua potential beneficiary, learns of something questionable, that would be discovery prior to the passing of the decedent. Is that what you were suggesting?
Justice Miller-Lehrman, I'm suggesting that there would be an argument then that discovery had discovery of the claim and accrual of the claim occurred at that time. I'm not sure that this court has rendered a specific decision on whether that is in fact the way things should operate under Nebraska law prior to, you know, even if they're a beneficiary, but prior to designation as a personal representative. I could see the argument being made that if they knew, even when in their capacity as a beneficiary, that the tolling doctrine of the discovery rule would not apply because that individual did have personal knowledge of the transactions that gave rise to the claim.
So that's what we were just exploring. If she's wearing her hat as a potential beneficiary / family member versus her hat as an official personal representative.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you. I don't have any questions, so I think that that concludes this oral argument. I want to thank you, Mr. Johnson, again, and thank you, Mr. Krejci, again, for participating in this manner. And thank all the members of the court also for their participation in this telephonic exercise. And with that, the court will be adjourned and you all are excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.